Dåliga vibrationer är att skära av sig tummen i köket.
Ja!
Bra vibrationer är att du har en tumme till och kan scrolla vidare. Få bra vibrationer med Vimla. Mobiloperatören med Sveriges nöjdaste kunder enligt SKI.
Välkommen till Unionen.
Hej, jo jag ska ha lönesamtal och undrar om potten. Ja, om jag kan räkna med övertidsersättning, för det är så stressigt på kontoret, jag jobbar hemma på kvällarna, så kan jag då be om större skärm från chefen, för annars kanske jag säger upp mig själv. Och hur lång uppsägningstid har jag då?
Okej, vi börjar med lön.
Jobbigt på jobbet. Som medlem i Unionen kan du alltid prata med våra rådgivare.
Välkommen till Momang, ett nytt smidigare kasino från Svenska Spel, Sport och Casino, där du enkelt kan spela hur lite du vill. Idag har vi Gonzo från spelet Gonzos Quest här som ska berätta hur smidigt det är.
Sí, es muy excelente y muy rápido.
Tack Gonzo. Momang, för dig över 18 år. Stödlinjen.se.
Принято решение о проведении специальной военной операции.
He refers to only as a quote special military operation.
We've seen dozens of people being arrested here over the last 45 minutes.
This remarkable moment, an employee of a Russian state television network interrupting a live news broadcast.
В рамках союзного государства, а на совещании в правительстве обсуждали, как сохранить.
Марина Осинякова holding a sign that says no war. Stop the war. Do not believe the propaganda they tell you.
К сожалению, последние годы я работала на Первом канале, занимаясь кремлевской пропагандой, и мне сейчас очень стыдно за это.
Ja, den ryska journalisten Marina Ovsyannikova visade ett obeskrivligt mod när hon under pågående livesändning och på bästa sändningstid i statstelevisionen protesterade mot det ryska angreppet på Ukraina. I anslutning till aktionen hade hon spelat in en video som avslutades med ett budskap.
Выходите на митинги, ничего не бойтесь. Они не могут пересажать нас всех.
Gå ut och protestera. Var inte rädda. De kan inte fängsla oss alla. Men frågan är vad som skulle till för att få vanliga ryssar ut på gatorna för att stoppa kriget och välta Putin-regimen. I fredagsintervjun den här veckan möter ni Maxim Trudolyubov, rysk författare och journalist i exil. Tidigare har han arbetat som redaktör på tidningen Vedomosti och programledare på nu nedlagda radiostationen Echo Moskvi. Intervjun kommer att göras på engelska.
Mr. Trudolyubov, most welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Let's start with this extremely unusual and brave protest in live TV by Channel One editor Marina Ovsyannikova. What kind of courage does it take to do such a thing?
Well, that takes a lot of courage. And she, particularly in her situation, I believe she's been working there for years. And she never shown any signs of being in a position to the regime. She worked for the very mouthpiece that is responsible for most of the lies and propaganda that the Russian government is spreading. So that's quite a decision on her part to do this.
Before this protest, she had prepared a video that was released afterwards.
К сожалению, последние годы я работала на Первом канале, занимаясь кремлевской пропагандой.
There she said she was deeply ashamed over having worked airing propaganda from the Putin regime.
Стыдно за то, что позволяла говорить ложь с экрана телевизора.
I'm ashamed that I was letting them tell those lies from the screen. I'm ashamed that I allowed to zombify Russian people. We kept silent in 2014 when all this was just in the beginning. We didn't go to rallies when the Kremlin poisoned Navalny. We just silently watched this inhumane regime. And now the whole world has turned away from us. And even 10 generations of our descendants will not be enough to wash away the shame of this fratricidal war. We're Russian people, thoughtful and smart. It's up to us to stop this madness. Come out to rallies. Don't be afraid of anything. They can't imprison all of us.
Они не могут пересажать нас всех.
What were your thoughts when you heard her say those things?
Well, this is a human story. This is an amazing human story. She is probably the first figure like that from a large, large group of people who've been working for the government, for state-run television stations and all other media. The one change that I would think that's happened is that many of those people, we knew that before, many of those people were opposed to the regime or had their reservations, one kind or another. But they've treated their work, their jobs, as, you know, professional employment, and would never attach, or most of them wouldn't attach, any moral aspect to the kinds of things they've been doing up to now. And what I realize now is that this war has become a threshold for many, many of them. Employees of the state-run television channels or other media are starting to leave. People report. It's not been confirmed, many of those cases, but many seem to be true. So that's the kind of mood that is spreading inside the propaganda machine. Because people seem really to crossed that line between just being professionals who are, well, basically following orders and doing things because they know how to do them, and the rest is their private lives. They're not responsible for the actual content of the message. The higher ups are doing that. They're doing the professional stuff. That's that. But now they clearly they've all reconnected with the moral aspect of what they do.
When I saw that, I thought, oh my goodness, what will happen to her? And then the news came out that she had a fine on 30,000 rubles, which is, of course, some money, but I had expected a lot worse. How should one understand that?
Well, I'm not sure this is the end of it for her. I think they might continue persecuting her. I wouldn't exclude that. They might even think of creating some kind of show trial out of her just to scare others, because, well, basically, the big question now for the authorities is that many of those formerly loyal servants that they used to use in their propaganda and other machines, actually, they might start to flee because people have met their moral universe suddenly, and people, particularly mid-level or even higher-level professionals of all kinds, they are suddenly ashamed, and they, you know, there are moments in life where you can no longer live separately from your consciousness. So something's happening in that respect, and this is the Kremlin regime's, one of its many, many problems is this, that they might start losing their professionals.
A protest like this, do you think it'll have a major effect on the Russian population, or more a marginal effect?
Marginal.
And why is that?
Well, people have been zombified for so long. It all started in the early 2000s. So basically, Putin's story begins with two things. It's a war and it's media. So basically, he started what we now know is Second Chechen War, 1999. Immediately after, a couple months after that, he started to put major, most influential television stations under control. Both things clearly were important for him. He wanted to keep both the war and the kind of coverage he needed. And he's been very consistent in that sense. Basically, both directions of his rule continued ever since. Ever since.
A question that I asked in my Swedish introduction was this: what would it take for thousands and thousands of people to defy their fear and go out to protest against this war and against the Putin regime?
Well, most Russians would tell you that a really large protest movement is highly unlikely. It's a very difficult. The way Russia's security agencies work, they make it almost suicidal for people to go out. Well, the easiest way people sometimes do, because it's still legal in Russia to stand alone in front of some building, some government building, with a little sign on a piece of paper, even these people are being consistently detained. There are huge fines, and if you're detained the second time, it could be arrest. And the third time, it could be like a serious criminal charge. Maybe that will be possible once people are polled to see what's actually going on in Ukraine. Maybe that will happen, because you really need a tide. You need a tidal wave to stop this from inside the country.
The protesting journalist Marina Ovsyannikova has Ukrainian father and a Russian mother, and as I understand it, many Russians have close relatives and friends in Ukraine. I assume they talk to each other over the phone and that they communicate via social media and so on. So aren't they told what's going on by their Ukrainian relatives and friends, you think?
Well, apparently, again, this is not enough for a tidal wave, like for a really big thing that we need now. Russia is still, it's a large country, obviously as a landmass, but I mean, 140 million people. One feature of that society is that most people never left the country. More than 70% of Russia's population do not have a foreign travel document. So basically, they've only traveled within the country. The kinds of media they have access to is state-run television. Many have the internet, yes, the social media, they are on social media, but most of the social media they use, again, this is those are the kind of vehicles that the government controls. Facebook or Twitter, Instagram, still, despite their widespread, mostly have reach in Russia's big cities and the younger cohorts of the population. So, and again, if you look at the polls, you see that younger people oppose the war, older people tend to support the war, but I wouldn't exaggerate the way of those polling results, because you are doing your polling in a country where most of the people are have no clue. They're confused. They don't understand what's going on. Plus they are scared. So again, it's not like an apology. I do think that the best way for our country, Russia, to prove to the world that we worth at least something in this situation, which will haunt us for generations, I think the only way to prove to the world that this country has a society is for all people to go out. But we are not there yet.
What could make the Russian people end there, where they think this is so important, I'm ready to take the risk?
Well, I don't believe there could be one thing that would trigger a mass protest movement, but many things together might actually do that, because many people still have not realized the full scale of the pressure, because this is not reported, essentially. They don't understand what's going on. They don't understand that those sanctions imposed by the West will probably remain indefinitely.
Let's get back to the sanctions in a while. But I heard one story in the New York Times podcast, The Daily. It was about a son called Misha, who's living in Kiev, tried to convince his father, who lives in Russia, that there's a full-scale war going on. Let's listen for a short while to Misha.
He told me that Russian soldiers, they're helping people, they give them warm clothes and food.
Misha's dad thinks it's essentially a rescue operation conducted by the Russian military.
And our army, they try to save you. They will not hit civilian people, they will hit some military objects and try to save you.
And not only that, he believes that Russian soldiers are liberating Ukrainians from this repressive Nazi government, and that the majority of the people want them there.
I told him, no, father, look, I'm here right now and I see it with my eyes. So look how it's going on in reality.
So this guy, Misha, he has big problems convincing his own father what he's experiencing in Kiev. What would your explanation be to that he doesn't even trust his son's first-hand information?
Well, that's... you know, I've seen that. This is not just one story. A friend of mine just was telling me she lives in the United States with her family. Her mother is in Moscow, and this mother of hers, she's not like a completely uneducated person who's never been able to realize, understand, and make her own assumptions based on reality, based on information. But anyway, what's going on there is that her mother has been going to her. She's a believer, an Eastern Orthodox believer, who goes to church often. So she would go to church and pray for Putin and say that with some of her friends, they're women, let's say, in their 60s or 70s. And where did they get that is a mystery to me, seriously. But there is a lot of that stuff. This is truly tragic. This is truly tragic. People have been brainwashed like really, really hard, deep.
If tens of thousands of Russians would go out to rallies, like in Belarus around the so-called election where Alexander Lukashenko won yet another landslide victory, how would Putin and his regime react, you think, if there's so many people out there that it would be impossible to arrest them all?
Well, you see, the Kremlin regime has now crossed into a territory that no of the living generations have experienced in their lifetimes. It's a truly dictatorial, despotic regime. What are they going to do is unclear, but what is clear is that they will do as much as they can in using all means at their disposal. They are desperate by now. They see that nothing's working according to plan. They still have a lot of resources, but the kind of resources they left, they're still unused, the most terrible kind. And so they're facing a terrible curve for them, that as long as they're not succeeding in taking one of the big cities, they will try to use more deadly weapons. And also, you know, part of this equation, you have to understand, is that a huge part of Russia's armed forces are now in Ukraine, including former domestic troops, internal troops. So they are internal. They should be based internally, and they're essentially part of the sort of heavy police force. Obviously, the thinking that the Kremlin has to have, I'm sure, is that in case of large-scale protests domestically, they would need this force. They need to keep it functioning. And to keep it functioning, they will be trying to save them and use heavier weapons, simply not to lose the essentially the kind of policing force that they would need domestically. They understand, they obviously they understand that Russia will face unrest in the future.
So they're occupied in Ukraine at the moment, and Putin is prepared to use a lot of violence to save them from dying.
That's my understanding. I mean, he's facing a terrible situation in the future, because even if he succeeds in occupying some parts of Ukraine, clearly not all of it, I don't think, he will need to keep it under control. And for that, you need a huge force. I'm not a military analyst. I don't know, but what I hear from people who understand he does not have enough manpower to hold a large country like Ukraine under constant occupation. It's a special sort of business. It's a terrible but special business, and you need a lot of force for that. But in many respects, he will also have to keep Russia under occupation, because we will see a lot of unrest. Russia is like a big dinosaur. It's just very big. So the signals that get to its nervous system, you know, with a lag, it's sort of slow moving and very big.
But it will happen. These signals will eventually.
Yeah, it will happen. It's inevitable. Belarus is a smaller state. It's a smaller beast, and that's why it was easier for people to realize what was going on. Also, a young generation was there, so it's kind of a number of things. As always, you have a number of factors that work in creating a certain, you know, societal phenomena. It will happen in Russia at one way or another.
Another factor in this equation is, of course, the sanctions. Do they work?
Well, I mean, studies show that sanctions work to a certain extent. They also, it's important that they work for long. You need a prolonged period of time for sanctions to actually start to really, really bite. And quite frankly, I mean, the examples of Iran or other countries under heavy sanctions, they show that a country that is determined, that has a huge police force and can scare their populations into submission, these countries can, unfortunately, survive for decades. I have no idea how Russia will survive, but sanctions won't work immediately. That's quite sure. I'm sure. One more thing is that Russian people, they're sort of divorced from their political life, because in large part because the Kremlin wanted that. So people sort of, they don't quite see themselves as citizens. They live their private lives. They're very individualistic. They have, you know, country houses, children, education, work. It's this, and everyone's contained within their usually smaller family rather than the larger family clans. So people are very, Russian society is very fragmented. So all of this body of Russian society to reawaken or actually to wake up, maybe for the first time, it's going to be a hard process. I mean, this society has been damaged, brutalized for decades, not just now. It's many people still remember the Soviet Union. Right now, roughly, it's half and half. The living generations of the Russians, roughly half of them, probably a little more, live here on this side of the Soviet Union. They've never experienced it, never had first-hand experience.
When the Soviet Union ceased to exist, that was almost without bloodshed. Do you fear that if the Russian people wakes up for maybe the first time, like yourself put it, that there may be a more bloody resolution to this?
Well, yes. I mean, many people say that this is what's going on now. The Kremlin's war with Ukraine has been an extended collapse of the Soviet Union, as was the case with Belarus, by the way. So, I mean, it's, yeah, we were all were saying, I remember back in the 90s, that we escaped the kind of bloody collapse that happened to the former Yugoslavia and all the nations within it. It seems that the end of the Soviet Union is progressing.
Hej, nu har vi på kvartalet högaktuellt tips till dig som är aktieägare och kanske i begrepp att få en aktieutdelning snart. Vad sägs om att skänka utdelningen till Fri Journalistik? Du kan slippa skatt på utdelningen om du skänker den till en organisation som är skattebefriad. Kvartal, som ägs av en stiftelse, tillhör den gruppen. En tusenlapp som skulle ha gett aktieägaren 700 kronor efter skatt blir 1000 kronor rent för mottagaren. Och som ägare av fåmansbolag kan skattefritt skänka sina aktieutdelningar. Men det här måste göras innan man som aktieägare kan disponera utdelningen. Läs mer om hur det går till att låta utdelningspengar bli en del av kvartalsfinansiering. Läs mer på Kvartals sajt. Skänk din aktieutdelning.
The Russian state has a large aspect that is criminal. And that actually, if you ask me, extends beyond the beginnings of the Soviet state, because the Russian empire was quite, something. What's important to me is that the criminal nature of the Russian state is coming back to us. It's come to haunt us, all Russians, and by now the entire world. And this I see as the big issue, the one thing that future Russians, let's say, or citizens of a future Russia that will, I think, still be there after the terrible atrocities that happen now, sort of after Putin Russia or after Putin after Putin, whatever is going to happen. But this new society will have to deal with some terrible past.
And that's not only connected to Putin or not even only to the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. So large parts of Russian society have been living in denial of what was going on during the Soviet time, particularly during the Stalinist period. But what's important is that the terrible atrocities and terror directed at its own people were not confined to Stalin. Stalin is just one example. It happened under Khrushchev, it happened under Brezhnev, etc., etc.
The West doesn't want to engage militarily to save Ukrainian lives. Their fear is that direct confrontation between NATO and Russia would lead to world...
Hej, Synoptik här. Visste du att solens UV-strålar kan vara skadliga och åldra dina ögon i förtid? Kom in till oss så hjälper vi dig att hitta rätt solglasögon som skyddar dina ögon. Välkommen till Synoptik.
CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PwC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PwC.
Ja?
Hallå? Pizzeria Grandiosa? Jag vill ha en Grandiosa capriciosa och en pepperoni.
Haha, något mer?
En kaffefilter.
Ja, okej, ses samma.
Grandiosa, hela Sveriges hempizza. Den med mycket på.
War 3. Do you think it's a correct assessment?
Well, we're in uncharted waters, I'm afraid. It's clear that that NATO possesses a potentially the kind of forces that Russia cannot possibly withstand. But Russia is a nuclear power, and that's something that prevents Western governments from using force against Russia, even establishing limited no-fly zones over Ukraine. I understand the thinking. Also, I mean, all of those political leaders, they are facing re-election what time or another. I don't know. Elections are happening in France very soon. Obviously, the US will have an election. Britain. So these are democratic systems. They have to think about those things. Russia is a very different beast. The Kremlin does not have to think about those things.
This is based on the assumption that one cannot totally exclude the possibility of Putin actually using nuclear weapons. Do you think he's capable of doing that?
He is capable. Particularly by now, he is capable. He is a desperate man.
So what are we going to do with that information? That's a pretty scary perspective.
Well, that's why he needs what they call a golden bridge on an off-ramp. Unfortunately, he is the most hated person in the world right now, and nobody wants to think about his own security or exit strategies for him. But an exit strategy for him will save the world from a nuclear disaster. So,
on the other hand, that will give him some sort of victory, which would be dangerous in another way, because why wouldn't he keep going then if he's victorious?
That's why it's all so difficult. And I'm sure that these strategic questions are being asked right now and being dealt with right now in Washington, in London, Berlin, obviously, Paris, Beijing as well, because it's a very complicated calculus.
Another factor that's often mentioned is the many dead soldiers on the Russian side and the effect that possibly could have on their parents and relatives. Could that unleash some kind of uprising or change when it comes clear how many people?
Something will happen, I'm sure. You need many factors. Russian society has been so heavily bombarded by propaganda and essentially zombified. So it's difficult for people to get back to their senses. Also, psychologically, imagine that you live in a certain bubble for a long, long time. It's painful to go out of it. It's for many, as I've heard this from some friends who are scholars in psychology, that people tend to become defensive. They fear that they won't be able, and that's kind of half subconscious. They fear that when they face reality, they won't be able to deal with it. So their defensive bubble around them just to keep going. So basically what is needed is a large scale re-education program for Russian society, for the Russians. It won't be able to happen under Putin, obviously. It will probably happen after.
Did the West miss a window of opportunity when the Soviet Union collapsed? The approach that was taken towards Germany after the Second World War with martial help and education and all that, it didn't really happen when it comes to the
exactly.
Soviet Union.
Yeah, this is one. This is an important aspect. The West needed Germany in the late 40s, early 50s, when the Soviet Union was probably at its strongest, at least it appeared so. And the Soviet Union had a newly created block of countries around it. So the West, particularly the US, needed Germany. And that was the reason why original plans, as you remember, were essentially to demilitarize and denazify it to the extent that it just remains all rural and basically, cows and chicken, and that's that. But they realized that they need Germany's industrial potential. They need it as a political force. It's a large country. It will have to be an ally within the you know, the Cold War, the Cold War's Western side.
But the same thinking wasn't applied to the Soviet Union, obviously.
Wasn't, then. Yes, wasn't. And my fear also, sort of long-term fear right now, is that once this is over and Putin is gone, and whoever is there heading Russia or whatever is going on, there won't be that much of an incentive for the West, or let's say for the free world, to help Russia get back, you know, and become part of the world again. Because there is no such a thing as a Cold War. Essentially, right now what we are facing is huge parts of the world united and appalled, determined, resolved to punish Russia and the Russians, by the way. Mm. And it's not what happened after the end of the Second World War, despite, again, everybody was angry and appalled at the Germans. But there was a certain political calculus, cynical as it was, to keep Germany on board. And I'm afraid that it's not going to happen with Russia after Putin is gone.
Lots of people in the West hope for some kind of Julius Caesar solution, that Putin's vassals would turn on him. How likely would such a scenario be, you think?
Well, nobody knows. I'm sure. It's a very complicated calculus, because he's been working on this for years now, so that he has these loyal vassals of his who surround him, and many of them, I think by now most of them, are under sanctions that they cannot leave.
So, and heavily invested in the regime, of course.
Yes, they're invested heavily. By now the entire security depends on Putin. So one thing that I can imagine, but this is, I mean, we are in it, it's a surmise, I mean, it's a complete fantasy, but what's important is that some high-ranking defections happen. It would be great if somebody who's like with sufficiently high rank defects.
And that could happen.
And that will help, because you need to break this vicious circle of codependence that they all have.
I want to discuss your interesting piece in the Medusa magazine with the headline, The Final Battle Against Reality. There you describe how Putin built up an alternative reality in Russia, and that you may have underestimated how dangerous that was. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yes, I have. You see, we started our newspaper almost simultaneously with Putin becoming prime minister, then quickly assuming presidential powers. That was late 1999. And we were much younger then, and Putin's cronies were younger as well. Most oligarchs were like in their 40s at the time. Putin was in his late 40s, for God's sake. I mean, he was a relatively young person. And I was editorial page editor with something called Vedomosti Daily, which for many years was Russia's very important business daily. So I was responsible for editorials and columns and all that, you know, op-eds. And so this regime's alternative reality building happened in front of my own eyes. I remember many of those people who were actually doing this. And, you know, I felt like an equal with them, in the sense that I thought that, I mean, this is ridiculous. This is so heavy-handed, so badly done, that it cannot possibly live. I mean, it's just, you know, you can find all kinds of metaphors for that. But it's clearly, it's kind of a dead thing from the start, dead on arrival.
That you didn't take it seriously.
I didn't take it seriously enough, yes. Dead on arrival, I was always sure. Because, and I knew those people. They're ridiculous. They're bad professionally. They never went to real colleges and universities. Many of them weird men, most of them men. And that proved a tragic mistake. I don't know what I would do, I mean, to break that, you know, spell of lies that they constantly use to create a completely parallel universe, essentially.
Because that was possible back then. You could have written column after column telling people the obvious, this is lies.
Yeah, I mean, we did publish, of course, a lot of stuff about that. But my strategy, in a way, the way I understand it now, was that we building a new Russia, we are creating, we support and we rely on the kind of real institutions that exist in Russia. NGOs, for example, and independent political figures who were still there at the time. And also, I mean, there were no, it's hard to believe now, but during the 2000s, there was no real Chinese wall between the expert, the kind of the expert community that I've been friends with for all those years, and the and Russia's government. People would go, you know, it's a revolving door. Many of those who worked for the government would then return back to the expert community and back again. So we realized that they are a different thing. I never ever voted for Putin and never had any illusions about the man himself. But many of his agencies, government officials, they were quite reasonable, well-educated, younger people as well. So we always had this belief that, you know, we can help change it from within. And there were really healthy discussions. There were real there was real progress up until a certain point. So I didn't really see that we needed to sort of battle against it.
I see. But was there a certain point now, when you look back, where, you know, a decisive moment or a time where this could have been changed in another direction?
Well, there were a certain number of thresholds, but I think the most important was 2011. Obviously, 2014, when Putin essentially went to war with Ukraine for the first time. There were some tells even before 2007, 2008. I remember, because I'm sort of a sensitive person, and I sort of official role is that Putin was doing back, you know, as far away as 2007. 2008, and they looked very much like Nazi parades. Mm-hmm. Black shirt, sort of fascist, sort of, you know, generically fascist, as if in a movie, you know, an imagined sort of theatrical fascist culture that it does not, you know, belong to any particular state, just a movie,
and that's what you saw.
That's what I saw. That's what I saw. I remember clearly. I watched that on TV in our newspaper in the office, and I was truly petrified watching that, because the imagery was unmistakably fascist. And I remember calling a friend of mine, an older person who is also Jewish, and we discussed that. And I was just speechless. I said, "Can you see that? Do you see that? This is." And I think to me that was the first moment when Putin started to sort of, you know, the mask started to fall off his face, and he found himself following that path on which he has now reached.
I have to ask you, you talked earlier on about how it's painful to go out of the bubble that's been built around you, and maybe also people help build that bubble themselves. How was it for you? When did your bubble burst? I mean, you're born in 1970, so you grew up in the Soviet Union for a while. Maybe you were never in the bubble, I don't know. How was it for you?
Well, my feeling is that I've never been in a bubble.
So you saw through it from the beginning, more or less?
From the very beginning. And even before Putin, to be honest. For a brief moment, we were all enchanted in the early 90s with all the new books and the new, you know, winds of change, all that. Mm. But the first Chechen war started by Boris Yeltsin. I remember watching, I wasn't a journalist at the time, so I wasn't writing about it. It was just a personal understanding that this country has again walked sort of, you know, terrible nature of this criminal state has reawakened and started to, you know, showing signs of life.
So you decided early on never to accept being in that bubble. Is that how I shall understand you?
Yeah, I think, yeah, more or less that. Yes, yes. I sort of always would be... I mean, it's not an apology. It's just an explanation. And again, I was always close to people who were studying Soviet history, also memorial culture, people who run Russia's most important, you know, civil society organization, the Memorial. They're close friends. So I always had this awareness of the nature of the state in Russia. But again, on the other hand, I was part of a certain, you know, culture, if you will, who saw themselves as a force for the future change, change from within.
A change that never occurred, at least not that kind of change that you
hoped. I mean,
for.
That's most of it is most of it in shatters by now. It's all gone.
Yeah. When did you leave Russia?
Well, I've never really like emigrated, you know, in one fell swoop. I won a fellowship at Harvard, the Nieman Foundation. That was 2010, 2011. Then I went to some other fellowship. So it was like this. I continued working because I still believed that, you know, I always wanted to outlive the system. They were going old, all of those, you know, madmen.
But with that perspective in mind, are you more hopeful now than you were 5-10 years ago that you actually will overlive them?
Well, I can only hope. And let's put it like this: this system is brain dead by now already. So the only question is time. They unfortunately have a lot of resources. They will be able to continue sort of exist on some kind of life support, which is terrible.
There's a very strong narrative coming from politicians within Ukraine. They say, we're not just fighting for our freedom, we're fighting for the freedom of the whole free world and Europe. And they say, he will not stop until he is stopped by force. And of course, they have their incentives to say so. But if you try to analyze it a little bit.
Well, what I'm sure is happening is that exactly because the West is unwilling to get this war to a new level, Ukraine is fighting on behalf of the West. This is true. And what the West is doing, the West is waging a war by all other means possible, other means except for the actual combat in the hills and in the streets. Today's beaches and hills and streets, they are the financial system of the world, technology. The U.S. possesses a huge power in being able to and support other countries with their technological solutions. So starving a country technologically, financially. So it's essentially it's only starting. We will see more of that.
Finally, I was spending an hour yesterday listening to Putin's address in Munich, 2007. It's often mentioned now a little bit when we know what happened afterwards. Let's listen to that for a short while.
Мы видим все большее пренебрежение основополагающими принципами международного права.
We're seeing a greater and greater disdain for the basic principles of international law. And independent legal norms are, as a matter of fact, coming increasingly closer to one state's legal system. One state, and first and foremost, United States, has overstepped its national borders in every way. This is visible in the economic, political, cultural, and educational systems it imposes on other nations. Well, who likes this? Who's happy about this?
Ну кому это понравится? Кому это понравится?
My question to you is, if you were self-critical, could you have done something differently when you were a journalist in Russia? In what way should the West, the politicians of the West, Merkel and all the others, be self-critical now?
Well, I mean, for a long time we've been exasperated with German policies toward Russia. Germany could have done a lot more, but German politicians have a long tradition of following new versions of their, you know, Neue Ostpolitik, which is in a way sort of the opposite of what the United States have been doing. So the Germans would keep trading with Russia and expanding that trade. They had a program of modernization that they've supported for a while, because they believed that, very strongly believed that you cannot just punish a society. You actually have to help it. Also, it's good business. Russia and Germany for a long time were the biggest trading partners. Germany was Russia's biggest. And that was technology, that was obviously cars, pipelines, everything that Russia needed, for example, for maintaining their exporting capabilities, but particularly pipelines and all the equipment that you need to export large quantities of oil and gas. So Germany was, for many years, even starting during the Soviet period, Germany was the Soviet Union's and then Russia's biggest partner in helping Russia to build this huge oil and gas bridge that connected Moscow and particularly Western Europe, by the way, because the partnership with Germany, France, Italy, Austria has always been the Soviet Union's and Russia's biggest priority.
So are your criticism mostly directed towards Germany? They could have done things differently if
Austrians, Italians, the French. Because obviously, I mean, Poland and the Baltic countries, they have a special relationship with Russia that will probably never be. They've never saw Russia as a partner or anything like that. But the Germans, and particularly simply because of the history of the Second World War as well, but also because of large influence that business community has over the Germans' politics. It has been like this. Also, the Germans, they believed, based on their experience from the 70s and the 90s, that they're building bridges, creating interdependencies, helped them to essentially to get Germany reunited and the Soviet Union collapsed as well. So they had a strong basis for their beliefs. I mean, the important thing is that books will be written long time after what's going on now. People will come to certain conclusions. I'm not sure that when I'm saying that I feel that I made mistakes in not taking them seriously, on the other hand, I don't really see how on earth could I or people like myself prevent that thing from developing. Even people with stronger opinions like Garry Kasparov, who I know we met, but I always thought that his position was too extreme. I always had this line of thought within me that you need to, you know, countries evolve, societies evolve, and we, relying on lots of sociological studies, we saw that Russian society is changing, and it was for a long time, quite a long time, changing for the best. All would seem to point into a direction in which you would have a different Russian society within years.
But that didn't happen. Let's see if it can happen after this terrible war is over. It has to stop someday, and the regime has to stop someday. Maxim Trudolyubov, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
Demideck presenterar fasadcharader.
Dörrklockan. Du ska gå in där.
Polis.
Fäktar.
Nej, tennis tror jag. Pingvin.
Alltså, jag fattar inte att ni inte ser. Nymålat.
Men det var många år sedan vi målade.
Demideckare målar gärna, men inte så ofta.
Välkommen till Telenor röstbrevlåda.
Hej min fina mamma. Kan inte du snälla swisha mig för fika? Älskar dig, puss puss.
För att repetera det.
Hej min fina mamma.
Spara samtalet när du förlorat den som ringde på telenor.se/missedcalls.
Dags att fylla på tanken. Stanna på Circle K så får du 50 öre rabatt per liter på dina tre första tankningar när du blir medlem. Vi ses på Circle K i sommar.